So, good evening, Bodhisattvas.
Good evening.
Here we are on the last night of our retreat together. I'll say some more about that at the very end on the closing circle. I'm going to give a talk. I hope it doesn't go too long, but I want to start by doing, it's not unusual, but I just want to start with a little attempt to just kind of off the cuff say something, and maybe, I don't know if it's clarifying something from two nights ago or just something that I thought of. And I think it's going to be one of those, Tenny went off the deep end again and it wasn't comprehensible. So partly because of that, I'm not going to take any questions about it right now, because if it's not clear and we start asking questions, there goes the night. But, you know, we can come back to it at the end if we want to, or maybe we'll talk about it one Sunday back in Tucson. So the occasion for it was the Creeley, to look at it as more than it was. And there was an odd sort of glitch about what that might mean, and it got me thinking about what it did mean and what the implications of that were. So I want to try and talk about that just quickly. So I'll take a just somewhat circuitous route. My Whitman teacher, when I was a graduate student, Quentin Anderson, was quite wonderful, describes the weird sort of consciousness in Whitman as, it's as if Whitman wanted to be a cat with the ability to apprehend its own cathood. And so I think what that's about, you know, is that Whitman wanted to be as close as possible to this just creature with no language at all, to sort of sink into that. But he also wanted that peculiarly human ability to recognize or notice himself being that and to appreciate what it was like being that. So just real quickly, that has something to do with the philosopher Kant's claim about human perception and apperception. So Kant says that humans have the ability to apperceive, which is to perceive their own perceptions, which would be something like Whitman, you know, wanting to be a cat with the ability to apprehend its cathood. And Freud, in his 1915 essay called Consciousness, links the mode of consciousness, which is peculiar to humans, and involves that apperceptive ability, that loop, the ability to perceive your own perceptions, to language. So he says, if we didn't have language, we wouldn't have that apperceptive loop. So that has something to do with being the cat with the ability to apprehend its cathood. And so the sort of crazy question, which actually seems really pertinent to Zen and meditation and various meditative traditions maybe to me, is why not just be a cat? You know, so is it the case that Whitman would have been better off if he'd just been a cat? And is it like sort of the fall out of Eden or something like that to be a cat with the ability to apprehend its cathood or to apperceive or to have language? So that brings me back to the Creeley, the thing about to look at it as more than it was. And John and I had some kind of double or triple mishearing. And so I don't want you to respond now, but if this isn't what you said, it's what I thought you said, so it's my confusion anyway. But so the phrase is really odd, and it's partly because it's in a poem, that to look at it is more than it was. I thought what John thought Creeley meant, or I meant Creeley meant by that, was that when there's something, like some emotion or, you know, sensation, and we look at it, we're making it more than it was in the sense that we're making it sort of way bigger and better. You know, it's like, now we've really made something of what was trivial before that. I think what Creeley's saying instead is much closer to the what a pity to say so, that as soon as we look at it, as soon as we, you know, sort of make that feedback back loop on it, we've almost done too much. That it was this thing, and in a way we've made more of it than it is, you know. So the question would be then, you know, would it be better to not look at it? Would it be better to not make more of it than it was? Would it be better just to be a cat, you know? All right. For me, that raises the question of, if you think about a kind of deep samadhi where you go completely outside language, you know, is it too bad that we have to come back from there? You know, would it be better if we just stayed there? And my understanding of the Zen tradition anyway is that it's sort of double-edged. So it says, you know, what a pity to say so or something like that. But it's actually really glad to come back. And I think it sees the peculiarly human gift or situation or capacity as that kind of feedback loop. But the Zen version of that, and I think often the poetry version of that, is not to make too much of it. You know, to be close to being a cat with the ability to apprehend its cathood. So you're both very close to being or animality or just sinking into it. And there's that peculiar human difference, which is probably a function of language. And I don't think on the whole the tradition sees that as a pity and wishes we could just be cats. That there's something wonderful about that peculiarly human ability. One thing about it, I suppose, is that we get to share the experience and, you know, help each other along with it. And also there is something about, you know, that image in the Coens of sitting together around the charcoal fire. In that moment of sort of being the cat apprehending its cathood, we can gather around the charcoal fire. And so aside from sort of helping each other out, you know, to see something maybe, in a way there's a peculiarly human intimacy about kind of sharing that experience, that as soon as you turn it into language, in some way, to look at it as more than it was. But it's not, it's a loss in a way, but it's also a gain. And then the last thing I'll say about that, because I'm on really shaky ground here, but my sense would be that that's close to what's going on in the Rilke-Duino elegy. Rilke's got a somewhat more maybe heroic vision of human language, but when he says that the world needs us to do that, it might be literal, and if it is, then it's about consciousness on earth and how human consciousness in a way is the kind of apogee of forms of consciousness. But I think it's also, I think there's a sweetness in it and a kind of communal sense in it, which recognizes that that's our human way of responding to the world. That moment where we notice and can notice ourselves noticing and share it with one another is the human way of participating in the world. And again, the attempt would be to use language in a way that somehow both acknowledges and celebrates that human difference and uses it to praise the world. And again, that sense of looking at it as almost more than it was is important. So for me, the Coens are a mode of language that try to stay very, very close to almost that non-linguistic consciousness. You know, but that the way in which they're linguistic is not a, well, the great thing to say, it's a disaster, and it's the peculiar, you know, like people always say about sentence teaching, it's a disaster, and it's a peculiarly human disaster, and there's something really wonderful about it. So that's, okay, so we'll come back to that if we decide to. That was sort of clear, right?
Yeah.
All right, okay, all right. So, this one's a little bit long. I don't think it's more than 24 or 5 minutes, probably a little shorter. So. In open source retreats, we have a tradition of turning at least part of our attention outward during the last evening, back toward where we're headed out to. If you got anything valuable from our retreat, Joan used to say, please go out and give it away. One way we can turn our attention outward is by spending time with the precepts, and we'll do that for a while later tonight. But I want to hover a little while longer with the quiet light we talked about Thursday night and see how that might open out toward thinking about precepts or vows. Let's start with another one of our reversible koans, which we glanced at the first night. Here's the real version. When Xuefeng was living in a hermitage, two monks came to pay their respects. When he saw them coming, Xuefeng let himself out of the hermitage door and said, "What is this?" A monk also said, "What is this?" Xuefeng hung his head and returned to the hermitage. Later that monk reached Yanto and told him the story. Yanto said, "It's too bad that I didn't tell Xuefeng the last word when I had the chance. If I had told him, nobody in the world would be able to handle him." "If you want to know the last word," Yanto goes on to the student, "it's just this." Yanto's apparent invective against Xuefeng here is a fairly common feature of koan repartee, and after a while we get used to taking it with a grain of salt. Invective, that is often praise, though typically double-edged, so that what looks like dumping on the other teacher is often a way of saying, "That's their teaching, good. Here's my different teaching, a compliment." And you can spell compliment with either an E or an I. Some versions of this koan have Yanto suggesting that while Xuefeng's teaching is actually closer to the source, it's maybe not so helpful to actual students, whereas Yanto's own teaching, he thinks, will bring them right along. Yanto's teaching, we might say, gets to the point. In relation to Xuefeng's question, "What is this?" Yanto's answer seems, well, pointed. This is a deictic, a pointing word. But in Xuefeng's question, which looks like it wants an answer, part of the monk's evident confusion might arise from not being sure what's being pointed at. That could also be true of Yanto's Just This, I suppose. But since it poses itself as an answer, it feels to me at least like it looms or zooms forward from out of the mysterious domain of Xue Feng's question. It's got at least a quotient of Quaker Oats to it. What, you know, just this, okay. Xue Feng's question, by contrast, feels recessive. What's right here in Yanto's teaching, what's just this, or just this, as a Japanese teacher in New York used to say, fades out into the expanse of whatever might be meant by Xue Feng's enigmatic question. What is this leaves you wondering or wandering. It doesn't get to the point, which is maybe the point or the no point. Not knowing is most intimate. To look at it is more than it was. If we almost glimpse or just barely glimpse a little of what is this out of the corner of our eye, or feel it sliding or shifting as we feel our way toward it, that fleeting quality of our perceptions or recognitions might also tell us something about what we're not quite able to fix in our gaze out there. The inward glow is everywhere and enduring, but each thing it plays through is fleeting, as is each momentary configuration of the landscape, just like our flickering glimpses. So what is this feels tender as well as intimate, a fragile recognition of a world of fragile life forms and all forms. Soto Zen especially likes to say that the question is in the answer and the answer is in the question. Yanto's answer, just this, has a question in it. What is this, or how do I see it for myself? And Xue Feng's question is an answer. That is, you don't have to answer his question, you just have to hold it or let it hold you. Mysterious, metamorphic, fleeting, tender, provoking wonder or awe, intimate. There's nothing lacking, nothing missing in what is this. Wansong says in his commentary that the monk, instead of parroting Xue Feng's what is this back at him, could have simply put his hands together in prayer position, gassho. I'd go instead for a full prostration in reverence to all of it. The case on which the magisterial Blue Cliff record comes to rest also diffuses our attention, drawing it to a diffuse and shifting light. But that's not how the koan starts. What is the blown hair sword, it asks. What's the sword so sharp that, as John Terence says, it would cut a single hair blown against it instantly in two? Joan goes him one better, saying it's the sword that cuts into one. The sword is a Tathagata machine, an image of a heightened perception in which one thing looms forward with perfect sharpness, exactly itself, blam. So the answer to the question in the koan is surprising and beautiful. What is the blown hair sword? Each branch of coral holds up the light of the moon. The sword's brilliant, sharp illumination gets diffused into a gentle underwater light. It's an image, Joan points out, of the warm water coral beds, vast, multifoliate, undulant, with the moonlight of awakening playing over them. So the light of enlightenment of Kensho, Manjushri's flashing sword, is refracted and disseminated, warmed, flickered, and given back, shimmering. You can, Joan says in her talk on the koan, lay back and rest in that sea, in that undulant light, always. It's an image of great peace, the great peace in everything. And it feels both eternal, the warm seawater, very old, bathing everything, and evanescent, fragile, the light as the moon moves and the waters shift, playing over and held now by this branch of coral, now that one. We may sense the fragility even more poignantly now, since the coral beds are vanishing. So the koan might provoke or invite not only our awe and tranquility, but also our tenderness and compassion, the domain of the bodhisattva. What's the loop between our bodhisattva vow, our commitment to awaken in order to help save all beings, and our readiness to be fetched by the fleeting and fragile beauty of the world? Joan offers a formulation in the Vimalakirti book that initially surprised some of us. When we make the bodhisattva vow, Vimalakirti's room, but read also the world, is radiant all the time, independent of circumstances or conditions. In this account, the bodhisattva vow comes first. Our sense of the fragility of things, provoking tenderness and compassion, softens our hearts and lets us see the radiance. But I think the radiance and the vow are also a Mobius strip or an oscillation, and that our commitment to the vow, which isn't ours alone, and our availability to the world's fragile beauty sustain one another. In the midst of our coming to terms with great suffering, pain, unfairness, and difficulty, Joan writes, it's also true that there is great tenderness, courage, kindness, and generosity in the world. Taking the form of Guanyin, Cohen says, find shelter for the homeless person. It's no accident, I think, that the Coral Sea is a dreamy or dreamlike image, and that the Blue Cliff record comes to rest there. What is this also invites us into a kind of dream. Everything is part of the dream of awakening, Joan writes in the Vimalakirti book. Why dream? One way to construe the phrase is that awakening is a dream, not in the sense that it's not real, a mere pipe dream, but because in awakening, the world reveals its dreamlike qualities. Awakening wakes us to emptiness, endless interpermeation, a flow in which nothing is as solid, stable, or separate as we are typically committed to believing. Everything floats up into existence out of and as the vastness, back into which it will dissolve. I marvel, Joan writes, as my hand figures out moment by moment what it means to be a hand, and my heart learns what a heart is on a sunny morning after days of fog. Am I pretending? Not exactly, but sort of. If pretending means a series of assays and approximations, one not knowing flowing into another with lots of pauses to listen. Outside my window are subatomic particles pretending to be trees. The world isn't only a dream, but it is in part. How do we tend to a dream? That's a question for bodhisattvas. Dream of awakening might also mean it's a dream in the sense that the world's awakening is not entirely real yet, not quite here. Or better, not realized, but always in progress, in process. So that if everything, as Joan reminds us, is part of the dream of awakening, that's not the only story it's part of. Or else the story or dream of awakening has lots of twists and foibles and tragic turns to it. Though the Cohens are stories of awakening, as always available and always already here, they hardly scant loss and suffering. That's crucial, by the way, to the complex burden of every day is a good day, at least in our Diamond Sangha descended lineage. A flowering of the Mahayana, the Cohens offer awakening as part of the useful equipment of the Bodhisattva, not the whole ball of wax, but a saving and sustaining grace that ought not to take itself for granted or make too much of itself or too little either. A resource, not a get out of jail free card. Remember the koan from a couple nights ago about the summit of the mystic peak? A quietude one might well want to sink into forever. And then in the koan, that's true, you're right, said Changqing, but a pity, he added. And later, Jingqing said, if it were not for Master Changqing, skulls would appear in every field. That's a warning about getting stuck in quietude or empty emptiness, as Hakuin called it. You can't turn away from your life, that's death, skulls littering every field. But in his commentary, Yuan Wu says something surprising and kind of out of character. He's typically fierce and mordant, but his comment here is full of pathos and tenderness. Why might we want to linger at the summit of the mystic peak, resting there forever? Here's what he says. The great earth is so vast and desolate, it kills people with sadness. One time when Dongshan was washing his bowl, says another koan, he saw two crows fighting over a frog. Someone who also saw this asked, why does it come to that? Dongshan replied, it's only for your benefit, honored one. If it's only for your benefit, what's the benefit? And we know that a benefit must be requited. How can you requite this one? A question for bodhisattvas. Here's part of a famous Dongshan poem. For whom do you bathe and make yourself beautiful? The voice of the cuckoo is calling you home. Hundreds of flowers fall, yet that voice is not stilled. Even deep in jumbled mountains, it is calling clearly. Maybe we can take up the precepts right here on this Mobius strip. Desolation and radiance, destruction and emptiness, suffering and tragedy and beauty and joy, with tenderness keeping it intimate. Not one and not two. two, shorter. In precept study, we talk about the formal precepts and the formless precepts. Shivayama Roshi says repeatedly in his commentary to the Gateless Gate that the koans are not stories about ethics. If they were, they wouldn't be koans, he says. Instead, he claims, they bring us to that root sense of things from which ethical conduct arises. That's a way of saying that the formal precepts arise from the formless ones, expressions of how the world appears from the vantage of however much emptiness as form and form as emptiness we've been able to sense and assimilate, and suggestions for how to requite that benefit. I've been talking indirectly so far tonight about the formless precepts. I want to say just a little before throwing things open about my recent hanging out with one of the formal precepts. I've been finding it useful to take a step back and spend a longer stretch of time than usual with the big, wide three pure vows, not moving too fast to the particularities of conduct explored in the 10 Bodhisattva vows. The three pure vows are global, and they seem to keep us pressed up against the fragility, suffering, and radiance of the world, and the tenderness those qualities elicit in response. I vow to do no harm. I vow to do good. I vow to do good for others. Since the three pure vows are so clearly impossible to fulfill, they invite us to spend more energy on inquiry and explanation and less on handing in our scorecard every 18 holes. More particularly, I've been spending my time the past month or so with I vow to do no harm, which seems to engage the formless precepts with special sharpness. Why do I keep causing harm anyway? And might a focus on this precept make even a tiny difference in the lives I touch? Here are some brief initial field notes, which don't claim to be ready for prime time. I've been finding that if I carry I vow to do no harm around during the day, it slows things down sometimes by a useful nanosecond. The old chestnut about responding versus reacting sometimes has a chance to kick in. Or when I do cross the line into thoughtless action, there's Joan's really useful step back to the moment before. In a way, I've already blown it, and it's too late. But in a way, it's not, and I might get at least a partial do-over. I can often mitigate the incipient hurt, and at least I don't have to let things snowball. I'm also finding it useful to, as Joan recommends, dive right back in then to the messy situation, read the situation I've made a mess of, and do the best I can, putting my initial unhelpful reaction and my reaction to my reaction into a keep-for-later mental folder to turn to when things are less pressing and I'm feeling less pressed. At that point, I can notice at least a little about what provoked my reaction. Was it something in the real situation or about the other person that I really need to think about and deal with, engaging either the other person or my own possibly distorted reaction to them, or both? Or was it just me being congenitally grumpy, or momentarily viscerally jumpy, or defensive, or doggedly attentive to what I thought I was supposed to be doing? Master Bodhisattva vow, my hardest one, because its opposite feels so visceral. I vow to be interruptible. If it's myself I need to look into, is there some deep-seated discomfort I need to investigate? Or, surprisingly often I find, something that feels more like just habit. And if it's just habitual, can I wean myself from it, at least sometimes? I'm sure my efforts are at best intermittent and the success is partial, but the practice does seem to make at least a little difference. I hope it's informed by the tenderness I was talking about earlier. As Joan says, not how am I doing, but how are we doing? I want to end by saying a little bit about I vow to do good for others, skipping over I vow to do good. Everything is part of the dream of awakening. That's true, a lifeline. But among the other stories that feel pretty compelling right now might be everyone has the capacity to fall in love with a strong man, think I alone can fix it, or fascism is a persistent tendency of the body politic. Given everything that's happening now and everything that's happened in the last few years, it seems remiss, to put it mildly, not to give as wide a meaning as possible to I vow to do good for others. And it seems dangerous not to try to find something we can do to be helpful just because we know we can never do enough, or not to be the kind of bodhisattva we suspect we can be because we're all too aware of the kinds of bodhisattva we're at least provisionally pretty sure we can't be. If we don't think, maybe for good reasons, that we should take action in the big arena of public life as a sangha per se, maybe we don't want to act in the name of someone in our group who might not be comfortable with what we're proposing to do, maybe we can be drafting bodhisattvas. I don't mean grabbing somebody else and drafting them to be one more bodhisattva in our project, but the other way around, in the sense of slipstreaming or drafting behind someone else to reduce the wind resistance and get the benefit of their forward motion. If one of your Sangha mates has found a place or a way to take meaningful action, maybe they can remember to invite you to slipstream if you want and join their efforts. In Arizona, which looks miraculously to be a possible swing state in both the presidential and upcoming senatorial elections, maybe related political action is a good basket for some of us to put some eggs in. But if not that, then what? Or if that, then what else too? It's a question I hope we'll come back to in the coming weeks and months. Thank you. So as usual, I'd welcome questions, comments, any kind of discussion, tangential conversations that leave the talk completely behind, or anything else.
I'd just like to say thank you.
Thank you, John. Thanks.
We'll have to think about it. And actually, we're recording it, so
yeah. Thanks.
Can go over it again.
Thank you.
I just want to say that that's the first time it ever clicked, or maybe it's the first time I've heard somebody talk about it, that our ability to speak language may be the key to ordinary mind and all of our conceptualization, particularization, rational analysis, discursive thought, discussion. That if you take away language, you know, we're more like the cat.
Yes.
Experience what we experience.
So something I really don't know about, but you know, Norman Fisher is like a big Dogen guy, and Norman's claim is that a key thing about Dogen's teaching is that Dogen is always all about language and all about how, you know, it all happens in language for human beings. Because we're human. So rather than trying to jettison it, you know, but this is all secondhand, but that Dogen is really about the linguistic aspect of practice.
That's really interesting to me, except that it's contrary to my impressions, like the Genjo Koan, so much of it. Of course, it's in language, that's why it's so beautiful, but it brings you out of your... sort of rational.
Well, yeah. But that's true of all the language I've been talking about, I think, that's designed to do that.
My apropos of that, this is the first time I heard anybody or read anybody going for the understanding of koan as a very close to non-linguistic consciousness.
Yeah.
Because as communicators, we can't get out of the language. Yeah. Heidegger would say, right? So this business of seeing something, the beautiful flower example, walking along and then say, oh wow, isn't that a beautiful flower? Yeah. So you bring it into the conceptual domain, and that's what I thought it meant, looking at the flower, if not saying it, that you kind of neglect the direct experience of beauty itself, just hitting us. So in that sort of garden, I thought it was less. But I think the poet and the other version is, it connects us to whatever we look at or label. The problem that I have is I recall reading that the Buddha purportedly said the problem is the label. So that's been my bind with going to you about the path of koan, which, you know, I keep going in and out of. It's words have made up most of my life has been about language. Having been trained by Chomsky to look deeply enough into the archetype, the best example of an archetype is this automatic language that no human can avoid,
yeah,
except for brain damage.
Yeah.
So it feels sometimes the language makes it less intimate and less tender.
Yeah.
Yeah. Than the experience actually, yeah, really is.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So a couple of, so one response to that is, if you're screwed anyway, you might as well enjoy it. I mean, if you can't get out, if you can't get out of language, you got to find a way to do it. But so I think everybody should talk about this. But my sense is that the non-linguistic conceptual experience is extremely important, and that's certainly part of the Zen experience. One of the things I've heard, and I don't know if everybody would say this, but supposedly that one of the differences between a deep samadhi and a kensho is that in a kensho, something like the reflex loop is involved. There is actually an awareness of the mode of awareness that you're in. And I know one thing Joan says a lot about doing koan work with a teacher, sort of bringing your reports, is that talking to somebody about it, and this would be that peculiarly human thing, actually gives it to you. And obviously it's going to change it, it's going to some degree conceptualize it, and so there's a loss there. But it gives it to you and makes it available to you in a way that it wasn't otherwise, so that the turning it into language in the right kind of way and the right conversation is actually a resource as well as a loss.
No, I can buy that.
Yeah. Okay. I totally agree with what you both said, and I just will say something that came to my mind, which has I've often observed is, when a person is injured in some way, it could be many, many ways, but say you cut yourself or something like that, or you have a headache or whatever, and there's the thing where you just have a headache, and there's the thing where it's like, oh my God, this is bad, 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 I have a headache. And it adds so much that is unnecessary. Yeah. And this is something we do as humans that I imagine, at least, that other animals don't do. Mm. And so it's another sense in which it's a pity to say so. It's a kind of a different sense, yeah, in which it's a pity, yeah, to say so. Yeah. But then there's also, as you're saying, the beauty of language and the just thing that pops to mind, there's so many examples, of course, but just, from the Heart Sutra, no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance in the fear of fear. And, I mean, there's just a zillion examples, but that, mm-hmm, is so evocative. It is, yeah, such a presentation. Yeah. And it's a glory all by itself. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah.
Pain's like that. So there's a sensation that we have that's aversive, right? So you pull your hand out of the fire. But if you've got something chronic, like a broken leg or something, I noticed what I was doing is going, ooh, this is gonna hurt. So I'd have this anticipatory story about this sensation. And then I'd have a sensation, then I'd go, oh my God, that really hurt. Which is a variation of what you're talking about, right? Is that there's the experience, and then there's an anticipation and a future looking at it and a past looking at it that make it a whole lot more than just, so your thumb hurts. Well, in the whole vast universe, you have this thumb that's really not real huge. But if you keep thinking about it, making it, focusing on it by future projection and past projection, then it becomes a whole lot bigger than what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there's any question. I mean, who knows the percentage, but I don't think there's any question that, like, Zen is at least like 95% committed to sort of getting around, sort of finding that space that isn't primarily linguistic. But I don't think it's 100% project.
That's good to hear. Yeah. regarding the exclamations, the oh, it's going to hurt, or the reaction, in many theories of language, that's not really language anyway. It's like the way animals vocalize everything. Birds do the talking, and the dogs the growling, and so on. So there's lots of vocalization that's not language in the sense that we have it as human.
Well, then there's the point, is language necessarily vocal?
When you're doing koans.
No, go ahead, Connie.
Things about language, if you're not saying anything, If you put sensors on your throat where your voice box is, it's activating.
That's so
and so it really is vocal, even if you can't hear it.
Well, it is too that our brains have a language center. I mean, there's a part of the brain that's specific for language. I did volunteer work for several years with people with aphasia that have lost their spoken voice. And yet you can't say they don't have language. So that's interesting.
Yeah, thanks.
There's body language.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, somebody can be saying something, but their tone of voice, their position, you know, shows that it's a lie.
Yeah, that's kind of. I want to thank you. I want to add something to that, or just sort of riff off it. So that's another crucial thing in Zen, right? So in koan practice, the most well, you guys remember Geraldine, the Tenzo. It was, so when Geraldine was leaving Pacific Zen Institute to go back up to the further northwest to be with her family, there was a celebration for her at St. Dorothy's Rest, and what she said there is some. Part of her speech, she said, the two most terrifying words in the English language are show me. You know, because if you're doing koan work, the teacher will usually say, well, you just told me, now show me, sort of make the presentation. And we don't do that, like, for all the many hundreds of koans or something, but it's a really important stage in koan work, and we come back to it a lot, that it be exactly, like you're saying, embodied knowledge. You know, that it be in your body. And the one crucial thing about the koans is that they become vehicles for embodiment. And I'll talk to you, and I have a whole paper on the relation between poetry and gesture and all that. So I think, I think it's really important, the embodiment stuff. And why did I bring that up? And the way in which reading or speaking language can actually initiate kinetic bodily gestures that before you're even aware of them. And I think koan work accesses that level of response and engagement and participation.
I'm feeling something about the ancestors of language, you know? Like, I don't know, I thought of I wandered lonely as a cloud, you know? And, like, I'm so touched that, you know, however long ago it was, 150 years ago, somebody wandered lonely as a cloud. And, you know, I feel it. Even though it's being communicated through language. I feel something about wandering lonely as a cloud that only language could convey to me in that context. So I'm like reaching across vast time and space. Going back thousands of years, we have some sort of contact that is like generating something and continuing to move us forward from the past. I mean, it's so amazing.
And there's a weird way, there's a weird way, I think, that in something like I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud, that it's actually a kinetic or, visceral, so it's something in the language sort of giving you a sense of that movement that actually gets into your body.
Right, it's like you strike a bell, and you strike a bell, and the bell answers, and it resonates, right? And so it's language and it's intellect, and yet it's beyond language and intellect.
Thank you.
Where is that from?
Wordsworth.
You know what's funny about that is that Zen monks are known as clouds and water.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. They wander lonely as a cloud. That's right.
So, Tenny, part of what I think we're kind of pointing at altogether, a lot of pointings at, is the emotion that comes along with a koan. Before it gets embodied, you're having these emotional reactions, which are most often not able to be put in words. We have a few labels for them, but the feelings are much more subtle and amorphous, like a cloud. To be able to identify in any way. And sometimes I hear that initial Buddha message about languages is that, you know, pay more attention to the emotion. Which always communicates, even if it's not language. So there's a lot of communication beyond the language.
So that's part of the show me deal.
And what about art as a communication of the koans of,
last year.
Aluk,
he couldn't be here this year.
But, you know, I mean, calligraphy has long been.
Yeah.
I mean, that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a really wonderful calligrapher at the retreat last year who did an evening presentation for a while and shared a lot of stuff with us.
The interesting thing is reading a poem or going to a reading. Like Donna's poetry, I've read her poetry for years, and I went to a reading that she did. It was completely different because there are so many other layers of communication besides the words themselves.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tenny, I wanted to mention, you know the koan book I have that's not the Cleary?
The Secrets? Secrets of the Blue Cliff Record? Oh, the other one. Yeah.
The other one. I can't remember the guy's name who wrote it. But he talks about the three nins.
Okay.
Nin being like a 1/20th of a second.
Okay.
And the first nin is the perception of whatever it is, you know, a bell or hearing of a bell. And then the second one is thinking about that bell, like what is that bell, or, you know, and putting, you know, putting some description to it. And then the third one is realizing that you're doing that.
Yeah.
And that reminded me of, because he talks about it when you're doing koan work, that the secret is to stay with the first nin.
Yeah.
And even if you go to the second nin, it's still possible, but. The third one, you're lost.
Let me talk about that because it does relate pretty directly to Koan work, I think. So I was given a paper at a conference at the university a couple years ago, and there was a guy from University of Chicago there, and he said that he was responding to something that I had said, which I'll tell you in a minute. But he said that there was a psych lab at the university where they'd done these experiments where they would ask like grade school kids, which glass of water has more water in it? And they'd be very, very close, you know, and the kid would go, oh, they're the same. And a surprising percentage of them, I mean, because they were so close, so the kid would hesitate and say the same, but the hand had already moved to the one that had more water in it, you know, yeah. And so one of the things I find teaching poetry that I do a lot, I call it hand criticism. And what'll happen is if a student is sort of groping around to find the words to say what they feel is going on at some point in a poem. A lot of times, if you look at what their hands are doing, it's completely expressive. Mm-hmm. And so, I think it's friendly by now. But I also said, well, you know, what's that thing? Well, we do that sometimes in Sangha too. You know, what's that thing you're doing with your hand? And it's almost always right there. You know, and so that, I mean, that's really an important part of how the Koans work, I think. Exactly. Yeah. And there's a kind of intimacy in that, you know.
Certainly embodiment.
Let me, as long as we're sort of going nuts here, another thing that is interesting to me in meditation that works for some people is when things get dreamy and you're just kind of running these sort of pointless movies through your head of sense memories, like the configuration of rocks in a yard, the place you went your summer when you were 12 or something like that, and then it goes to something else. That feels related in a way. I mean, there's that sense of sort of the world inside your body, you know, that a lot of what you are is just this collection of these kind of visceral responses and traces. I mean, there's interpermeation right there, you know. And so I think sometimes when meditation gets dreamy and you feel like, unless you're running stories, you know, about how your father abused you, you know, by not giving you a large allowance that same summer or something like that. I mean, I think that's actually good meditation, you know, when those images are just kind of streaming through with no rhyme or reason.
You know, in that case, it operates like a sign pointing to something more deeply.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And the koans are going to have signage and pointing.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. Probably, yeah, and probably that'll be registered in your body as some kind of feeling, too.
Yeah. Layers
of
you know, meaningfulness.
Yeah.
It's probably good, even with your father in there.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful that you just described the Alaya Vijnana.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's just the layer. And that brings for me that, you know, hands and eyes all through the body. You know, it's just experience.
Yeah. And then remember that's also the Tathagata Garba, right? So that like there's that mysterious image in the Lankavatara and other places, that sort of turns over and then it becomes your awakening. Yeah. But that feels really true, right? That in those moments that it's very close to that sort of intimacy with whatever, the world or the universe or consciousness or something. Yeah.
Reaching for your pillow and the
pillow. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, reaching behind your head, I think, yeah, for a pillow in the dark. Yeah.
It's probably too large a subject to address now, but I was interested in reading that koans in some schools always had answers.
Yeah.
And there was a book of answers,
yeah.
And that's what the koan meant, and that was what the intellectuals of the time, or the rulers of the time, who decided on what the koans meant?
Not me. Not me. No, that's a great thing to bring up. So I guess the Soto Zen, Soto would be a tradition that's not centrally focused on koans, right? So the Soto critique of the koan tradition sometimes is that it got too intellectual, and I think that was true at certain points. But the answers are usually part of commentaries. Uh-huh. Well, that's not right. They're commentaries, and the commentaries are attempts, even though they're pretty discursive, they're also pretty strange, you know? And I think they're attempts not to explain the koan to you, but to do one or another kind of jujitsu, you know, to sort of move you into a frame of mind where the koan suddenly sort of comes into focus and makes sense. There are koan books which are lineage traditions of a range of acceptable answers, and I'll say some more about that in a second. So in our lineage book, like if I have koan notes, mm-hmm. and you, like if you're working on koans with me, you see me looking at the notes, right? Those will go usually what, you know, something that Joan added. Sometimes it says A and G in there, which is stuff that people at Awakened Life said, stuff that students said that were meaningful to her. Behind that, there are usually comments of John Tarrant, who is her teacher. Behind that, there's a lot of Aiken comments in the book. Behind that, there's Yasutani, and behind that, there's Harada. And every once in a while, which is, you know, the Sambo Kyoden Diamond Sangha lineage. And then occasionally, there are Rinzai comments, and usually it's like, then it says, but Aiken did not accept that answer. You know, or something really beautiful like that. You know? And though that sort of commentarial tradition, not that sort of book of, you know, a sort of guide to acceptable responses, right?
Okay.
That itself is based on, you know, the 10th to 13th century Chinese collections, which, you know, were put together by Zen teachers. So it wasn't primarily intellectuals of the time. I mean, it's an entire sort of teaching tradition. The other thing about them is that they're not answers like in the sense of like 63 and a half or something like that, but usually they indicate what we're looking for in the response. And so when I sort of joked around a couple months ago with John, you know, about what does the koan want, and, you know, you rightly sort of said, well, what, you know, what the hell is that? That's what I was referring to. There's an entire sort of lineage tradition, like a kind of rabbinical tradition, about, you know, sort of what's involved in the koan and what might the koan bring out, and what are the range of responses that would lead you to say, oh at least for now we're done with the koan. So that's
yeah, kind of what I'm hearing is, excuse me, John, that what I'm hearing is that's part of the dialogue that you were, it's an extended dialogue about what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was concerned that we'd all be sitting around trying to find the one right answer.
Yeah.
And it's a secret into land, and only the master knows.
Yeah.
Say, I'm not going to do this language game.
Yeah.
You know, this is endless.
Yeah.
But on the issue about making a note about some element of meaning, meaningfulness, something being meaningful in some way, the thing is, that's going to go on forever.
Yeah.
Any next mind who's encountering it can think, oh, this part's pretty meaningful. And so you never know what's in that in terms of, I don't think.
Yeah, and we're very much a tradition that's willing to sort of add to the range of acceptable responses and to make up our own koans. And this is, I don't know, well, in our tradition, another thing that happened when the Pacific Zen School sort of got going and separated from the Diamond Sangha is that the koan discussions became way more open-ended, they tended to become in various ways more personal, and that people would sort of talk about what the koan elicited in them. And Joan made a great point often about saying that, you know, if you're actually taking somebody through the curriculum because they're committed to that, you want to stay with them until the presentation sort of, you know, to offend you again, sort of gets at what the koan wants, you know. But very often, a lot of the stuff that happened on the way to that was more valuable and meaningful than the canonical answer. So there, it's really open-ended. And one of the pleasures of doing koan work with people, and it's not every time at all, but there's so many koans that will really affect somebody really deeply, you know, and they'll have a very deep reaction to them.
Yeah, that's the big emotional impact. That's what I'm in for.
And that's the thing about using language again, you know, that you can, just like Helen and Martha were saying, you know, that sometimes the words will really pull something out of you in a way, you know, or elicit a response for you that you're very grateful to have had the occasion to have happened.
They can put a spell over you.
Yeah, that's right. So what about, there are a few people who haven't said anything? Maybe if, you don't have to, but if you...
I'm being like a cat.
That's great.
Wrong answer.
No, that's great.
That's how I said in the book.
There's another, like Ezra Pound was always sort of channeling Confucius in a bad way, but that one of the cantos has Confucius at the end. A bunch of students give an answer to something he said, and somebody says, which one was right? And he says, they've each answered correctly, that is, each one according to his nature. So that, I mean, that's really a part of the koan work as well, for sure. Anything else? What an unexpected conversation. Thank you. Thanks.